Today we begin a sequence of two lectures on the subject of the Puritans and the settlement of colonial New England. Now in this first lecture we're going to focus primarily on Puritan society, how it was organized, what its principles were, who the Puritans were in the first place, things of that nature. And then in the second lecture we're going to focus primarily on Puritan interactions with the natives of New England. Now, in order to understand the Puritans, we have to begin with a little bit of European background. In fact, so little, unfortunately, given the scope of this course, because we're primarily focused on U.S. history, that it's almost scandalously little. There's much more that could be said, but I just want to give a brief overview of the Protestant Reformation out of which the Puritan tradition develops, and then we can understand the context, the religious context, of the settlement of New England. So I'd like to begin with 16th century Europe and the tumult religiously that began to take place following the Protestant Reformation, in the wake of the Reformation. This was a religious revolt against the established religious authorities of the time, namely those of the Catholic Church. And I want to begin by talking a little bit about Martin Luther, even though it's another theologian, John Calvin, with whom we tend to associate the Puritans. But as you'll see, some of the ideas of Luther are, in effect, foundational. And, of course, Calvin will have his refinements and changes. But being introduced to Luther, I think, is important because he's going to get the basic contours of Protestantism onto the table. So first, who is this figure, Martin Luther? Martin Luther, 1483 to 1546, was the son of a copper miner, and it was assumed that Luther would go into the law, because then, as now, that was the path to a lucrative career and to influence. But with the passage of time, it became clear that that would not be the path that Luther would follow. And in fact, the story goes that in the early 16th century, Luther was caught in a terrible storm, and he was so concerned that he might not survive it that he prayed to St. Anne that if he were delivered safely from the storm, that he would then devote his life to the service of God. And so he decided to do just that, to consecrate his life to God's service by entering the monastery and becoming a monk. Now, it seems clear, based on Luther's temperament, that it was almost certainly a mistake to have admitted Luther to the monastery. He seems temperamentally unsuited to the monastic lifestyle. But in particular, Luther suffered terribly from extreme scrupulosity. He was constantly reproaching himself for his sins. He could barely, at times, bring himself to gaze upon the crucifix, because he felt himself being rebuked from the cross at his incorrigible sinfulness. And as time went on, other monks began to be concerned about Luther's conduct, and finally his religious superior, Staupitz, took him aside and urged him for spiritual consolation to review the letters of St. Paul in the Bible. Now, of course, Luther was reasonably knowledgeable in the scriptures, to put it mildly. But the idea here is that the letters of St. Paul are an inexhaustible source of Christian wisdom, so one ought to advert to them regularly. So Luther did just that. And what's significant for our purposes is what Luther discovered, the particular verse and how it hit him, that the just man lives by faith. Now, first of all, we have to understand, what does the just man mean? What does that term mean? What does the Bible mean by just in that sense? Well, in that sense, the Bible is referring to the justified man. Well, that might not seem like it sheds too much additional light on the question, but so we have to ask the question, what is justification in the biblical sense? And justification, a person who is just, who is justified, what all this boils down to is that you have a soul that is pleasing to God. And so justification is the process by which the soul becomes pleasing to God. And according to this verse, the just man lives by faith, well, Luther took this to mean that the just man lives by faith alone. He later explained that the context indeed justifies this interpretation, so to speak, that the just man lives by faith alone. And his interpretation of this is that the man whose soul pleases God is the man who lives by faith alone, not by good works. So here's Martin Luther, who is constantly all too aware of his inability to perform good works, of how short he falls of the standards of God, how far short he is of Christian perfection. But now he's reading The Just Man Lives by Faith. Well, he does have a lively and robust faith. And that's what makes his soul pleasing to God. And Luther would later say he has a kind of a view of extrinsic justification. That is to say that the soul is made pleasing to God through an exterior action. That is to say that it is as if Christ places his cloak of righteousness over the sins of the justified man. It's not that the sins are actually washed away. The justified man's soul is, in Luther's colorful phrase, like a snow-covered dunghill. So the dunghill is the accumulated sin, or the accumulated sins there, but it's the righteousness of Christ that covers them over and thereby makes the soul pleasing to God. That is the process of justification. And so now Luther is convinced that it's not by the sacraments, by offering or attending masses, or going on pilgrimages, or engaging in mortification of the flesh, or whatever types of religious devotions you might pursue, or the pursuit of indulgences, or anything like this that leads us to God, but rather faith alone. And for Luther, this is a great source of religious consolation and really emancipation, because it does emancipate him from the terrible self-doubt and the terrible spiritual torment that he'd been enduring. And so this becomes the centerpiece of Lutheran theology, is this emphasis on faith alone and the complete inability of man, unaided by God's grace, to do anything that could please God. That original sin, that is the primordial act of disobedience by Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, had completely destroyed man's will, that nothing he did could please God, that even things that looked outwardly good were tainted by man's self-love and other factors. So the idea of justification by faith alone becomes really the centerpiece of Lutheran theology. I mean, Luther even says that my whole teaching stands or falls with the doctrine of justification by faith alone. Now, the Catholic view of justification had been that the soul becomes pleasing to God through an actual, in effect, washing of the soul through the sacramental life, through the recourse to the seven sacraments. And these actually, in effect, washed the soul and made it clean. And this was a lifelong process of sin and falling, and then the recourse to the sacraments to wash it away and begin again. This is rejected in the Lutheran schema. Now, having said that, we also may note that Luther also taught the principle of sola scriptura, that is, Bible alone, that the Bible is the sole source of knowledge, religious knowledge, that is to say, for the Christian, that there's nothing else. There's no, it's not church councils or popes or some kind of sacred tradition, but rather the Bible alone. Now, there will be among Protestant thinkers a continuum of belief on some of these principles. So there would be some who would take the principle of Bible alone to an even greater extreme than Luther did. So Luther, for example, would say that infant baptism is part of the Christian deposit of faith, such as it is, even though he may argue that it's not expressly called for in the Bible. It's hinted at, you can find some indications of it, but his view is that since it's not contradicted by the Bible, and it does seem to be of long-standing tradition, then he would accept it. There would be others who would go even farther than this in terms of Bible alone. But these are the sorts of things. He is removing what he believes to be some of the accretions that have attached themselves to the Christian faith over the centuries. Now, we also need to talk about predestination, because this is really central to understanding the Puritans and how they organized their society in colonial New England. Now, predestination follows from original sin. First of all, what is predestination? It's the idea that your eternal fate, that is, if you're going to spend eternity in heaven or in hell, is in effect determined in advance, even before the beginning of time, but certainly before you came into existence in this world. And it follows from original sin, because Luther had a very severe view of original sin, that it indeed destroyed man's will, it destroyed his reason, such that it became impossible for man to do anything pleasing to God without the grace of God. So he was utterly unregenerate and helpless to do anything that would be pleasing in God's sight. So if that's true, then there's no way he could ever go to heaven. He's completely unable ever to get to heaven, because he is so wounded and so unable to perform meritorious actions in the sight of God. So he deserves hell. Everybody deserves hell. So although the teaching of predestination may seem harsh and unforgiving, for Luther it was actually quite a relief to believe in it, because technically nobody deserves to go to heaven. So if God chooses some people through some reckoning that we're not privy to go to heaven, then this is pure, gratuitous goodness on his part, and we should rejoice at this. Now, of course, this is a source of great difficulty for many people at the time. His own ministers, some of his own followers, found themselves in great torment, wondering if they were indeed among those who had been chosen for heaven. And Luther's advice to his ministers was simply to urge people not to think about it, that we simply trust in Christ, and that's what the Christian believer ought to do. Now, a small technicality here: what Luther believes in is what theologians have sometimes called single predestination. So that is to say, people who go to heaven are chosen by God to go to heaven, but those who go to hell send themselves to hell through their own wickedness. It's John Calvin, another Protestant theologian, who later advances the doctrine that's sometimes been called double predestination, that God both determines expressly those who will be admitted to heaven and those who will be condemned to hell. So God actively decides that so-and-so will go to hell. But the point is that for our purposes, the Puritans who come and settle in colonial New England believe in this, and they're going to try to organize their society around it. So who are the Puritans? Well, to understand the Puritans now, we have to understand the introduction of Protestant ideas into England. And here, well, there's a great history here, very, very interesting, but we'll just say very briefly, I used to spend so much time on this when I used to teach Western civilization, but King Henry VIII initially, and in fact throughout his life, was not interested in Martin Luther, and he wasn't initially even interested in breaking with the Pope, as of course Luther did, teaching those things. You would have to break with the Pope, and he believed that the Pope itself, the papacy itself, was an unbiblical office. Henry VIII did not hold that view, and in fact was given the title Defender of the Faith for his work on the Seven Sacraments against Luther in 1521. What estranged the Pope and Luther, and Henry VIII, was that Henry wanted to get an annulment of his marriage with to Catherine of Aragon, who was his first wife, and she was not bearing him a male heir, and he believed this was her fault, and he wanted a male heir. He wanted to marry Anne Boleyn, who was not satisfied to be his mistress but wanted to be his wife. And the Pope refuses to consent to the annulment, and sides with Catherine of Aragon, who insists there are no grounds for an annulment. This is a perfectly legitimate marriage. Well, finally, Henry impregnates Anne Boleyn, so it becomes absolutely urgent that he get the annulment of his first marriage. He doesn't want to have an illegitimate child that would defeat the whole purpose. So the Pope won't grant him the annulment, so finally Henry breaks with the Pope and declares that the King of England is the head of the Church of England as well. And so at that point, the Archbishop of Canterbury declares, in conformity with the wishes of the king, that his marriage to Catherine of Aragon was indeed invalid, and his new marriage to Anne Boleyn was valid. And the religious officials become relatively accommodating, because then, not too long after that, it was, interestingly enough, determined that Henry's marriage to Anne Boleyn was invalid, and his future marriages were each in its time valid. But what concerns us here is that initially, typical Englishmen wouldn't have even noticed that anything religiously had changed in his country after the break with the Pope in the early 1530s. Wouldn't have even noticed. The prayer for the Pope in the Liturgy of the Mass was removed, but that prayer had been said silently or in a low voice by the priest anyway. So people would still would not have noticed. Their religious devotions were unchanged. So it was not that Lutheran ideas spread to England and that was what happened. But with the passage of time under the regency of King Edward VI, who was a boy when he became king, and in fact was sickly through most of his life, this is where those who do want to push England toward Protestantism begin to have their influence felt. And with the passage of time, there is a move toward making the church in England more in conformity with Protestantism. But the Church of England always occupied a sort of anomalous place along the Christian continuum from Catholic to Protestant. Well, the Puritans were those people who believed that the Church of England was not de-Catholicizing rapidly enough, that it was maintaining some of the trappings of Catholicism in the form of its authority structure, certainly in the form of its elaborate worship and ritual, and sometimes it was believed that the Church of England was not adequately and consistently enough pushing the doctrine of justification by faith alone. The Puritans in particular focused a lot of attention on the liturgy. They thought that the great ceremony, the liturgical pomp and circumstance, as they would have conceived of it, was a violation of what they assumed to have been primitive Christian practice, and distracted the worshiper from really what's the essential part of Christian worship, and encouraged superstition. And what they wanted to do was to purify Christian ritual. I mean, now Calvin, of course, who was the one of the key theologians in the Protestant Reformation, but Calvin had argued even that there shouldn't even be any musical instruments at all, and that there shouldn't be adornments inside the church building. And so this sort of thing began to occupy the Puritans' minds, that they wanted to purify the worship. For them, the center of the Christian worship was the sermon, was the preaching of God's word, that this is what reaches the heart of man, is hearing the word preached. And anything else is a distraction from this, from the lengthy sermon, scripturally based sermon. That was the central focus for them. So these are the Puritan objections to the Church of England. It's still too Catholic for them, in effect. So, the Puritans ultimately decide, many of them, that trying to live their religious convictions in England is a rather a trying enterprise. So they got to get out of there. First, some of them settle in the town, English town of Scrooby, but find that they're harassed by the authorities and it's just too difficult. And so some of them make their way to Amsterdam and then Leiden, because these were places, it was thought, where religious toleration, you had to leave the country entirely to find true religious toleration, This is where religious toleration could be found, and where they could practice their beliefs without being harassed or having their ministers harassed or their property confiscated or what have you. So as time goes on there, and now we're into the early 17th century, as the second decade of that century proceeds, a lot of these Puritans begin to think that this is that really being Dutch, that the Dutch environment is not a good environment for them. Number one, they believe that the Dutch were a poor moral example for their children. And secondly, they believed that it was that perhaps they had underestimated the extent to which they wanted to raise their children as culturally as Englishmen. And this was hard to do in a Dutch cultural milieu. So perhaps it was time to leave once again. And so some of these folks ultimately made their way to what became Plymouth in 1620. So as they make their way to Plymouth in the Mayflower, they make their way over, they get to Plymouth, they make a compact among themselves, because they had the original terms were they were supposed to settle further south than they did. So that when they wound up settling in Plymouth, and whether they accidentally went off course or did this deliberately, we can't know. But when they arrived in Plymouth, the fact that they were in Plymouth, in effect, invalidated their charter. So they decided they better make this compact among themselves to establish a legitimate sovereign office to govern them. And so they did that in the form of the Mayflower Compact, saying we are making this compact among ourselves to acknowledge the existence of a sovereign office that will make rules for the governing of our colony. Now, the people who settle in Plymouth, these are the people we know of as the Pilgrims. So the Pilgrims are the first group of Puritans who come to colonial New England. So all Pilgrims are Puritans, but not all Puritans are Pilgrims. But secondly about Plymouth, these are what are known as separating or separatist Puritans. And what's meant by that is that they wanted to turn their backs on the Church of England entirely. They thought it was utterly corrupt, through and through, could not be redeemed, and that the thing to do was to turn their backs on it, live their lives the best they could following Puritan precepts, and let the chips fall where they may. Let the world go to hell in a handbasket, in effect. That was their opinion. It was very much, in the real sense of the term, an isolationist type of perspective. Well, by the 1640s, Plymouth was largely a ghost town. It had not been particularly successful economically. It had not attracted a great many settlers from the beginning. And it was really just a backwater. By the 1690s, the crown had in fact merged it in with Massachusetts Bay, which was the second and the by far more significant and larger of the two major Puritan settlements, and we'll talk about that right now. In 1629 to 1630, we begin to see the second major Puritan migration to Massachusetts, this settling around Massachusetts Bay, and one of the significant figures there is the longtime governor of Massachusetts Bay, John Winthrop, and we'll have more to say about Winthrop in a minute. During the 1630s, some 21,000 men, women, and children came to settle in Massachusetts Bay. And unlike colonial Jamestown, whose settlement was largely driven by bachelors, this was basically a family-driven settlement. A husband and wife and usually a couple of children was the typical model. And they came over and settled. In fact, bachelors were by and large discouraged. In fact, in Puritan society, they didn't want people coming over living by themselves. They didn't like the idea of people just living by themselves. You might be tempted to fall into sin. Much better to have somebody living with you. So they discouraged people living alone. So it was a family-based migration. But these people are called non-separating Puritans or non-separatist Puritans because they believed it was wrong for anyone to turn any of these people to turn their backs on the Church of England. That yes, it's a horrendous thing, it's a catastrophe, but there are a lot of people there who are stuck in it. And we, as Christians, can't turn our backs on our fellow human beings. But we have reached the limits of what we can accomplish by trying to reform it from within, or reform it from within England. This just can't be done. So what we can do instead is come to Massachusetts, live the Puritan life the best we can, and hope that our example is strong enough to transform the Church of England. So that really is the sort of motivation that you see behind this great settlement, that we have a great mission to perform in the New World. And that mission is the regeneration of the old world through the sheer force of our example. Now, it's true that the economy was poor in England in the 1620s. There were bad harvests and weather, and the cloth industry was suffering. But that didn't mean you had to go to Massachusetts specifically. There was this commitment to this vision of establishing real Puritan society and having it as a magnet, a light to the nations. And that's how we should understand John Winthrop's remarks in his sermon, in his address, a model of Christian charity, and his biblical imagery of the city upon a hill. Because he says that our colony will be as a city upon a hill that cannot be hidden. And I sometimes remember people would say that in the 1990s, thinking back to Ronald Reagan's day, as Ronald Reagan said, America is a city on a hill. Well, actually, it was John Winthrop who said that colonial Massachusetts was a city on a hill, and even he is getting this imagery from the Bible. But if you read Winthrop's words, you don't have to be sympathetic to Puritan theology to find a certain beauty in it, that he's saying that we've come here with a great mission before us, and we all have to work together. We have to help each other. We have to, if somebody has a deficiency of something, we have to devote ourselves to making up that deficiency. You know, someone has something in surplus, he should offer it to someone who has a deficit. We should look after each other and care for each other and show kindness to one another, so that our great example will redound throughout the world. People will be attracted to what we're saying, because they'll say, "Look at how good they are and how generous they are." There must be something about what it is that they believe. But if to the contrary, we are constantly being uncooperative and backbiting and fighting and engaged in argument and discord, then God will withdraw the favor that He has shown to us. And surely our mission will fail, and we will be the laughingstock of the world, and the cause of God will have been defeated. So this is serious business we have here. He says we must pursue the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace, in a reference to Ephesians. So he's using this sort of language to appeal to everyone that we all have to work together and think of ways to get along and be as good and decent and generous and just with each other as we can. Well, it's interesting to note, how did they organize that society? And in particular, we start with how they organized their churches. And we'll recall that the Puritans believed in predestination. Well, what they're going to try to do when they decide who gets to be a member of the churches that they establish is they're going to try to reproduce in their churches the elect that God has chosen for heaven. That is to say, they believe in this sort of doctrine of visible saints, which I'll get to in a minute. But basically what they're saying is that we want in our churches to try to approximate on earth what we're going to see in heaven, so that people who will enjoy membership benefits in the churches will be those whom God has chosen to spend eternity with Him in heaven. Now, how the obvious question that refers itself to the mind here, presses itself upon the mind, is how are they going to know? How do they know which people God has chosen? And here they realize they have to make an educated guess. And here's where this doctrine of the visible saints comes in. Of course, they do not believe that good works could lead you to be admitted into heaven. Only God's gratuitous gift could get you into heaven. Certainly nothing you do could make you worthy of it. But things you do, your piety, your hard work, your outward efforts and works can be a reflection of the fact that God has elected you. It doesn't cause it, but it can be an effect of the fact that God has chosen you to rank among his elect. And so although it is invisible to the human eye who are the elect and who are not, what is visible is the conduct of people. And we can make an educated guess on that basis. And so how do they get started then? I mean, who gets to pick the first one? Who chooses the choosers? The choosers are a group of people called the pillars of the church. Yeah, usually seven, but could be sometimes more. Seven people who mutually identify each other through a kind of winnowing process where they say, you know, I mean, I've examined my soul and my conduct and my life, and I believe I have good reason to think that I'm among God's elect, and I've known Fred over here for a while, and he gives me good reason to believe that he's also among the elect. And so finally they decide who the pillars of the church will be, and then they subject all would-be members to an interview, an interrogation, as it were, asking them about their religious lives and why they themselves, what kind of testimony they can offer that would justify their belief that they are indeed among the elect. And if they answered these questions to the satisfaction of the pillars of the church, they would be admitted to membership. Now, of course, again, I think another sort of question that impresses itself upon the mind is, wouldn't it be rather offensive to people who have gone to all this trouble, come all the way over here to Massachusetts at great expense and great sacrifice, that they would do this only to be told, sorry, we don't think you're going to heaven, so you can't get into the church. I mean, maybe we'll re-examine you next year. Wouldn't this be offensive to people? Well, yeah, it might, sure. But the fact is that from what we can tell, early on, the vast majority of people were indeed admitted to church membership, because it was one of the factors working in their favor was the fact that they had had the foresight and the good religious sense to make the trip in the first place. So a lot of the pillars of the church believe that that itself spoke very well for you, that you had the presence of mind to join us on this important mission over here. Okay, so you're admitted to church membership. What does that get you? Well, for one thing, you can receive the Lord's Supper. You can participate in this, which was a monthly ceremony for the Puritans, where one would receive bread and wine, which is kind of an image for the Puritans anyway, of the Last Supper. And this was restricted only to those who were church members. But also you could vote in the colony. You could vote if you were a church member. So that's where we see, so you see how all this stuff, when I started off talking about the Protestant Reformation and predestination, it seems kind of remote from colonial Massachusetts, but now we've come full circle and we see now how it all fits together. That the doctrine of predestination leads them to the belief in the elect, and this leads to their desire to build their churches a certain way, and the church membership then determines who's allowed to vote. So that's how the religious ideas work into the political ideas. Incidentally, historians are actually at a bit of a loss as to how it is that they came to decide to organize their churches this way, because the Puritan churches earlier than this had not done it this way. So it's a bit of a mystery. Now, strictly speaking, in the strict definition of the term, colonial Massachusetts was not a theocracy in the sense that those who occupied offices in the church could not occupy offices in the state. Ministers could not hold political office. Okay. Now, King Charles likely did not realize the Puritan aspect of the colony that became Massachusetts Bay when he approved its charter. What's also significant is that the royal charter did not specify where the stockholders' meetings would take place. It was a joint stock company where they raised money from investors that hoped that the settlement would turn a profit, which it never really did. And that's how they helped to raise money for it. Well, where do the stockholders' meetings take place? The charter doesn't say. So the company decides, well, we'll just have the meetings right over here. And so a lot of the decisions that are going to be made for the colony are being made far away from the king. And so there's a wide scope for self-government right off the bat. The company and the colony operate from the New World. The colonial government of Massachusetts consisted of an elected governor, a council appointed by the governor, and a general court that was composed of two delegates elected from each town. And the general court had both legislative and judicial functions combined. The government of Massachusetts proscribed certain behaviors that they believed to be incompatible with biblical injunction. At the same time, we should recognize that even in this society, there were safeguards of the liberties of the people, in particular in the form of the Massachusetts Body of Liberties, which was approved in 1641 and contained about 100 provisions. And longtime Governor John Winthrop was actually voted out of office because he was temporarily to get, and they got this Massachusetts Body of Liberties established, and then he was voted back in. Winthrop had been very much against the Massachusetts Body of Liberties because he believed that we need to govern this colony according to biblical precept, and my judges need as much leeway as they can in order to judge in accordance with biblical precept, and I don't want to hem them in with a lot of man-made laws. Well, the colonists were not convinced of this, and they thought it was indeed better to have some kind of written codification of their rights. So they got that in the form of the Massachusetts Body of Liberties, and if you look through it, you will see some principles that are going to be familiar to you, which are of long standing in the British tradition with regard to not being deprived of your life, liberty, or property without due process of law, or no taxation without representation, and things of that nature. Now, finally, what I want to talk about today regarding life in colonial Massachusetts is dissent, because that tells us something about what life was like and political life there. And I want to focus on two dissenters primarily. The first one is Roger Williams. Roger Williams was an associate pastor in Salem, Massachusetts, and became very influential, and he got himself into some trouble with the authorities of Massachusetts. And we get some sense as to the position of dissenters in the colony when we look at some of the town charters. For example, the Charter of Dedham, Massachusetts, includes this provision: "We shall by all means labor to keep off from us all such as are contrary-minded, and receive only such unto us as may be probably one heart with us." Well, Roger Williams was not one heart with some of the other Puritans. Now, a lot of times you'll see textbooks focusing on the alleged dispute between Williams and the authorities of Massachusetts regarding the rights of the Indians to the land. And it's alleged that Williams had a big argument over this because he said the Indians have the right to their land and the colonists' claims to the land were therefore illegitimate. But it turns out that if you look at the record, that they did not consider this a major dispute with Williams, because really it was entirely a theoretical dispute. It was just a dispute over at what stage of the settlement process should the consent of the Indians be sought. Because the king was in effect granting political rights over this land before the colonists got there. But when they did get there, they did, as I'll show you in the next lecture, they did in fact acquire the land with the consent of the Indians. Whereas Williams was just simply making the theoretical point that the king shouldn't have initially said, okay, here, go ahead and treat that land as if it were yours. It's not. Well, okay, but in practice they didn't anyway. In practice they did seek the consent of the natives. And not all whites did, but one thing we can say about the Puritans is that it is not true that they just came in and took the land. So really this is not a central point. The central point, well, there are a couple of them. One was that Williams did not believe that the secular authority, the government, had the power to enforce what's sometimes called the first table of the Ten Commandments. The first four commandments is what they usually refer to that way, the ones that deal primarily with people's obligations toward God. This is something that people have to do as individuals, and the state does not have a role here. Well, that was news to the government of Massachusetts. Also, Williams was increasingly, it was clear, he was a separatist. This was not the spirit that the Puritans in Massachusetts wanted to encourage. They thought that was deeply uncharitable. And it got to the point that Williams began to argue that you could not, that magistrates could not tender oaths to unregenerate men, that you could not pray even with people who were unregenerate, that and so that could sometimes mean, I mean, ultimately Williams got to the point where the only person he felt like he could really pray with was his own wife. This was not the kind of teaching that the Puritans wanted. And so ultimately, Williams was given the boot. After a couple of rebukes, he was finally ordered, in fact, back to England. And John Winthrop decided that, you know, look, I wouldn't want my worst enemy to go back to the England of Archbishop William Laud, where they were enforcing just what the Puritans considered to be liturgical atrocities. So Winthrop actually informed Williams, look, they're coming to get you, and they're going to send you back to England. You better get out of here. So Williams made his way to Providence, Rhode Island. And Providence becomes a kind of haven for individualists, for people who can't get along with the authorities in Massachusetts. And that becomes de facto a place of religious liberty, Providence. Now, the second dissenter I want to talk about is Anne Hutchinson. Anne Hutchinson, she and her husband came to Massachusetts around 1634, and they began to she began to hold in her house weekly meetings, talking about, and twice weekly, talking about the sermon of that week and expounding upon that, and then later just talking about other religious issues. And a lot of people, a lot of women attended, and then later both women and men attended these meetings. But the trouble with Anne Hutchinson from the establishment's point of view was that she rejected the idea. She promoted the view that sanctification does not equal justification. Sanctification, in other words, the process by which someone becomes saintly in his conduct. Well, she's saying that the mere fact that somebody may have good conduct is no indication that that person is among the elect. Well, that, of course, goes right to the heart of the organization of the whole colony, which is precisely based on the idea that we can make this determination. Now, the colonists freely admitted they were fallible and that they may admit to church membership somebody who doesn't belong, and they may fail to admit somebody who does belong. They admitted that. But by and large, they thought they could do this, and she said they could not. Well, and then also she begins to condemn virtually all the ministers of the colony, with the exception of a couple of her friends. She says almost all of them are teaching a covenant of works, justification through works rather than through the grace of God. So finally, well, she's brought up before the authorities, and they want to know where she's getting these crazy ideas, and then she says that, well, God in effect told them to her. And from the Puritan point of view, that, well, then that's it, because we have established authority here. We cannot have somebody who claims to be getting direct revelation from God that can override the directives of established authority. So 1638, out she goes, and she likewise makes her way, for a time anyway, to Providence, Rhode Island. Okay. We're going to stop here, and next time we're going to begin by talking about a little bit about Connecticut and New Haven, that is sort of offshoot settlements in New England, And then from there, we'll talk about the controversial, that is, from a historical and scholarly point of view, relationship between the Puritans and the Indians.